Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. Today we hear from the Consul General of France, who is visiting from San Francisco, and get his take on the global effects of the Trump tariffs and more. We talk with a returned Peace Corps volunteer with experience in Ukraine. What's the fate of the program as DOGE moves in to make cuts? We meet a chatty bush warbler on today's Manu Minute that's more often heard than seen. And a Tony Award-winning musical makes its Hawaii debut. Why a show about a 20th century murder helps us make sense of the times we live. Thanks so much, Russell and Kat. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Let the trade wars begin. Well, just a week ago, the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, suggested European companies put a pause on investment in the United States, given the uncertainty around the global economy. With tit-for-tat tariffs swirling, our longtime allies are perplexed. It comes at a time as our European allies have been strengthening their positions in the Pacific because of the threats from China, Russia, and North Korea. This morning, the new Consul General for France out of San Francisco paid a visit to our studios. It is the first trip to the islands for Florian Cardinaux.
I arrived last September in San Francisco, and I wanted to visit Hawaii soon, but I wanted to have a good occasion. And the good occasion came when I decided to come with two very special people from my Ministry of Foreign Affairs, our ambassador in charge of the Indo-Pacific and our ambassador in charge of the Pacific. So I decided to coordinate this visit with them to make the best out of it. At a time when, as you said, we want to strengthen our cooperation with the U.S. in this part of the world, and at a time when we do much more than we used to in the Pacific and more broadly in the Indo-Pacific. And you know, we are at a very special moment for us when it comes to our strategy in the Indo-Pacific. Our president will be the chief guest of Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore in June. And before that, he will tour the region. He will have a state visit in Indonesia, a partner with which we are really developing the relationship, the strategic relationship, very quickly, very fast. And I was with the president Macron, with President Macron, our president, when he toured the Pacific on the summer of 2023. It was the very first visit of a president in Pacific Island countries, president of France, because all of them went to our territories in the Pacific, because you know we are a nation of the Pacific. We have territories there, French Polynesia, New Caledonia. But none of them had been to neighboring countries, neighboring islands. And he visited Vanuatu, he visited Papua New Guinea. And at the time he launched a renewed French strategy for the Pacific, committing much more financial means on development, on civil security, on defense as well, to cooperate, to strengthen the cooperation with Pacific Island countries on topics like environment, climate change, renewable energies, and so on. So we are doing much more than we used to in the Pacific. And the idea about my visit and the one of our ambassadors here was to see how we can do more with Hawaii.
With all the headlines about the trade wars, the tariffs, you know, there was great concern because I believe it was Macron who said maybe France ought to put a pause on U.S. investments because of all the uncertainty. And the tariffs have kicked in. And so everybody's wondering about, oh, what's going to happen to my French wine and champagne, you know, which some people cannot live without. But yeah, how are you looking at these interesting times?
Well, first, it came as a surprise to us, in a way. And we did not, and we still don't understand the rationale behind it. My president, the members of my government, told it very clearly. And my president was the first European leader to come to Washington to have a discussion with President Trump on Ukraine, on Russia, but also on the economy, on trade. Transatlantic trade, the trade between Europe and the U.S., has always been very strong. It is very strong and very dynamic, both ways. We don't think it is unbalanced. When you look at the big picture, when you take into account the services, for example, and not only the goods, we think, on the contrary, that it is a balanced relationship. And we are so interlinked. Everything is very much intricated when it comes to the value chains of many industries. 2 weeks ago, I was in Seattle. I was visiting Boeing facility of the 737, the engine of a 737, the cables of a 737. Many spare parts of the 737 come from France, from aeronautic industry based in France. Safran, Thales, Dassault. So everything is interlinked. So we don't really see the rationale behind it. We think it's bad for everybody, that kind of tariff wars. And we are trying to, you know, to discuss, to exchange. Of course, it is first and foremost at EU level, because when it comes to trade, it's the competency of the EU. And we try to find a reasonable solution. But what is clear is that we will not bow. There will be countermeasures if we don't find the solution. But what we hope is to find a reasonable agreement in the interest of everybody. Well, we hope it will be the case. We keep exchanging with the US administration. My president has a good relationship with President Trump. He already had a good relationship during his first term. Actually, I think they respect one another. They know how to listen to one another. And so we are building on this relationship to try to find a solution.
I think this is an opportunity for people to learn about the ties. You know, I was thinking all the companies like, you know, Michelin tires, right? I think there is a Air Liquide, a company here, you know, the ties with First Hawaiian Bank. I mean, just those economic ties, the business ties. And then there's the history, you know, with the allies. I was recently at a dedication for the Mercy boxcar back when there was this outpouring of support from Hawaii. We sent sugar. The folks of France sent over things for us as well. And so it's hearkening back to that time and those relationships and how we were there for each other when there was a great need. And so I guess as we navigate through this, yeah, you have to be sensitive and tiptoe around. But at the same time, these are everyday issues that face people here in the U.S. as well as in your country.
You know, the fundamentals of the relationship are very strong. They remain very strong. They will remain very strong. France and the U.S. are the oldest allies. We have always been together. And it's true that when we come to Hawaii, when we go to Pearl Harbor, I visited the headquarters of Indopacom yesterday, MacArthur, Nimitz. I mean, it's you know, it reminds us of our common history when we fought together, being in Europe, in the Indo-Pacific. France was part of the war in Korea, for example. We have always, you know, be side by side in difficult times, and I think it won't change. So history matters. We are very close relationship. And when it comes to this part of the world, French Polynesia is the closest islands from Hawaii. We are neighbors. And we are not only neighbors. When you look at the history of Hawaii, it is very much linked to the one of French Polynesia. So we have a lot in common. And it dates back from centuries. I'm not even mentioning the history of Lafayette coming to the U.S. So we have to build on this to keep trust. And the relationship is strong in defense, definitely between our military people here in this part of the world. They are coordinating all the time. They are exercising with one another. Actually, our aircraft carrier was for the first time in the Pacific, close to the Philippines, doing exercises with you, with Japan, a couple of others, allies and partners. But it's much broader than defense. You know that renewable energy here in Hawaii, most of your solar plants were built and financed by our national electricity company, EDF. When it comes to, water waste and so on, we have a company, Veolia, which is operating one of the main facilities here in Honolulu. And when it comes to people-to-people relationship, it's also quite strong. The Pacific Fest was organized here. Next edition will be in Noumea, in New Caledonia. Oh. So we are neighbors. We do a lot together. And we think we can do even more. So the reason of my presence is to try to see what we can do more.
I know one of your lawmakers had a statement out there in the media that maybe perhaps that France should take back the Statue of Liberty. You know, that was a gift way back when. But the whole idea and the spirit behind the Statue of Liberty and the ties, like you said, that bind us. Complicated times we are living in.
No, honestly, I will not comment what this member of French Parliament said. It does not reflect the position of my government, my authorities. The Statue of Liberty is U.S. But what is true is that it's linked to us. It's part of our common history. And we are very much attached to this history, as I said, and to our values, our common values of democracy and liberty. But you know, nothing else to say about the Statue of Liberty, yes, which is very well where it is in New York.
Yes, but it did make all of us think about the symbol and what it stands for, yeah, and the interesting times that we are living in now.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we are the oldest allies. We are very much attached to our values. And we have a lot of things to do together. We might have our differences. You know, there is a formula which is very often used in my country, which is we are allies, but we are not aligned. And it's true that we are not always agreeing with one another. And I think, I'm quite convinced, and I think that, you know, that's the position of my authorities, that our differences is our advantages, of both of us. Because there are things we can do, you cannot. What matters is to remain allies and to keep defending the same values and the same vision of the world.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Merci and mahalo.
Merci beaucoup.
That was the newly named French Consul General in San Francisco, Florian Cardinaux, who is paying his first visit to the island. He met this week with military brass at the Indo-Pacific Command, as well as the governor and key officials at the East-West Center, Pacific Forum, and Daniel Kainoi Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Beach House Restaurant on Kauai, now hiring multiple front and back of house positions. Application by searching the Beach House Kauai.
You are back with The Conversation on this Wednesday. And this weekend, members of President Donald Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, paid a visit to the offices of the Peace Corps in Washington, D.C. There are fears that the DOGE team will try to shut down the agency as it did with the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, earlier this year. The Trump administration abruptly laid off thousands of workers who were in jobs overseas and cut funding to many programs abroad. One program USAID does support is the work in developing countries by our Peace Corps volunteers. This morning, the National Return Peace Corps Volunteers Group held a virtual town hall meeting to share what they know about the DOGE visit. Carolyn McKenzie heads up the Hawaii group of returned volunteers. She was on the call at 5 a.m. this morning to try and get the latest.
What they know is that the International Peace Building and Development Organization was dismantled. Number two, the DOGE visit was planned. They knew the DOGE was coming on that Friday. What they learned is that the DOGE crowd tends to come on a Friday and then work through the Saturday weekend. So Peace Corps was prepared for the visit, and all the Peace Corps volunteers overseas have been notified. And so far, no Peace Corps operations have been disrupted following this visit. And the other good thing is that the Peace Corps Partnership Program, which is Peace Corps' way of getting project money for Peace Corps volunteers, it's all family and private donations, is back open. It has resumed, and our volunteers can raise money for projects. Their SPA and USAID grants are frozen, but they can accept money for projects from family and friends and other networks.
And we understand that there's more than a dozen volunteers from Hawaii right now across the globe.
Right. I just double-checked my list, and we have 15 right now. And what's interesting, given all the chaos of what's going on, I emailed two of my Peace Corps volunteers that I sent care packages to. One is in Liberia and one is in Rwanda. And she sent me a message because I was concerned how they're doing and what's going on. And I will leave her name off, but she is in Rwanda. And she said, we're not allowed to talk about any of the cuts or anything that's going on with the media. But she said she could tell me that her job never stops turning and that she is working with her students and her team. She is in a training college for teachers, and she is busy working with the Student Success Center, helping the teachers in better training so they can be better teachers when they go out to their schools. And she has attached all kinds of wonderful pictures. So in essence, even through all this mess, the kids are doing their jobs. And it's the best example for me of the American spirit overseas. We are nice people.
Huh. Well, you know, you shared a story with me about another Peace Corps volunteer who was in a panic because I guess some of the aid, USAID money dried up and he was trying to get a computer lab going in the village or something. Share with our
that's
listeners.
Correct. No, this is our volunteer that's in Liberia. He comes from Hilo and he had $2,000 left for his computer lab project and he lost it and he contacted us almost immediately with help. And our little return Peace Corps group would love to help him, but we don't have $2,000 in the bank. But the thing that's cool is that the Peace Corps and Rotary have a partnership. So we told him to check, see if there was a local Rotary in his district, because for the last 4 years, the partnership, Rotary and Peace Corps, we've been pushing for more information and trying to get our Peace Corps volunteers overseas to learn about the Rotary partnership. So as it turns out, we're still doing the research, but it looks like the Rotary in Hilo, where he comes from, is working really hard to figure out how to get that $2,000 to him soon. So there's lots of positives in this situation, and it's amazing how the local networks come to the aid of Peace Corps and our Peace Corps volunteers.
Yes, I mean, that's really heartwarming. And April is volunteer month.
Right. That's right. So we have 15 going overseas now, and we have three more slated to leave in May. We'll have a send-off party for them here on the Windward side. And if all goes well, they will be on their way to serve overseas. I believe it's Nepal, South America, and I think Africa. But yes, we keep our fingers crossed. One of the other things they talked about this morning on the national virtual call was that what is concerning is when the budget begins, when the current president submits his budget for 2026. That's where we are going to focus our interest and our push. And as they were saying, the best thing that all of us can do is to contact our local congressional representatives and push to support Peace Corps. And here in Hawaii, it's a blessing because all of our congressional reps really like Peace Corps.
There are just so many in our community who served in the Peace Corps. The one that comes to mind is Republican Representative, you know, the late Gene Ward. You know, we just lost him, and he was a big Peace Corps supporter.
Oh, big time. And the other one we just lost, I think I sent you the message, was Mary Matayoshi, whose son or grandson, I believe, is in the legislature. But Mary was the director of the training center over in Hilo in the 60s when the Peace Corps had training on the Big Island. And we also have, I mean, the University of Hawaii, it's fun. I've been on the radio station over at UH because there are a whole number of returned Peace Corps volunteers over at the university. And since I run the group for the state, we have about 200 here on Oahu. We have 12 over on Maui, and we have over 300 on the Big Island. So when we rally our troops, our congressional reps get lots of messages on their phones and in their inboxes.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, I believe President Trump did try to cut the funding for the Peace Corps in his first term, but I understand there
Correct.
Was bipartisan support and kept it going.
Right. No, it was. In his first term, he was going to cut us. And basically, the military stepped up for our defense, and there was a letter that the top brass of the military sent, 110 signatures of all the top brass, to send it to the past, when he was president in the past, basically saying that they could not do their job without Peace Corps volunteers on the ground. So he backed off cutting the agency, and he cut our budget. And President Biden increased our budget, which is the budget we're living on right now. But we shall see what happens, and we can only hope that we get Congress, the bipartisan support in Congress, to come to our rescue one more time.
Yes, I mean, it's difficult because we saw what happened with USAID and this whole notion of soft power and diplomacy not being held in high esteem as it was and as it is in many circles.
No, it's sad, but what I learned, and, you know, I submitted an op-ed to the newspaper, and thankfully the Star advertiser published it. But the quote that came to us from Washington was about President Reagan, who wasn't quite so sure about the Peace Corps. But by the time he learned about it and met Peace Corps volunteers, they represent the heart and soul of this country and our nation. And that is still true today. And when you look at, I mean, my network of returned Peace Corps volunteers, my group, I stay in touch with my site mates from Ukraine. I stay in touch with my Ukrainian Peace Corps staff counterparts. We are the heart and soul of the nation as far as volunteer work goes. And we are asked to support, and we talk about what we learned in the countries where we serve. So it's such a wonderful program. It's an education for so many people to learn about what we did, where we were. And I can't tell you enough about how wonderful the Peace Corps is, and it has to stay alive. So all the listeners, please support Peace Corps. Contact our congressional reps and save us, really.
Well, we hope that those 15 Hawaii residents out there volunteering won't have their contracts cut short, and that those that are looking forward to going will be able to complete their service. But thank you so much, Carolyn.
Oh, no, thanks for helping me push the message. Peace Corps is great. And thanks. Thanks for public broadcasting for always coming and talking about Peace Corps. I appreciate it.
And that was Carolyn McKenzie, head of the Return Peace Corps Volunteer Group here in the islands. McKenzie was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ukraine many years ago. She says there are hundreds of former volunteers living across Hawaii.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art with Homa Nights, open until 9 p.m. Fridays for art experiences, live music, film, and dining. HonoluluMuseum.org.
We now go to this week's Manu Minute. We have got the song of the shy Japanese bush warbler, thanks to the Mokale Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Japanese bush warblers are small, mostly brownish songbirds with a distinct white eyebrow or superciliary line above their eyes. Because they spend most of their time in dense understory vegetation, they're really hard to see, but it's their loud, very distinctive song that gives them away. There are two main types of song. The first has a long introductory whistle ending in a syllable. The second is mostly a long descending series of double notes. Known as uguisu in Japanese, they're one of the best known and loved songbirds in Japan. And after a long winter, that song is viewed as one of the first signs of spring. It's sung only by the males to advertise their territories and try to attract females. These birds are also highly regarded for their droppings, which are the main ingredient in a very effective skin cream that's been used in Japan for centuries. Hawaii is the only place in the world where Japanese bush warblers have become established outside their natural range. They were first introduced to Oahu in 1929 to control insects, and expanded on their own to all the other main Hawaiian islands, most recently making the long flight to the Big Island in the 1990s. Sexes are similar in plumage, but the males are almost half again as heavy as the females. Unlike most other songbirds that are monogamous, male Japanese bush warblers are polygynous, where a male sets up a territory and pairs up with multiple nesting females. Japanese bush warblers are found in a variety of native and non-native forests across the state and seem particularly attracted to areas of dense uluhe fern, where there are often very few other bird species. We still don't know a lot about their ecology here in Hawaii, but at least for now, they don't seem to be having a significant negative impact on our native birds or forests. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, supporting their communities, habitats, and wildlife. More about helping at friendsofoahunwr.org. Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
Manoa Valley Theater is staging Hawaii's first production of the musical Parade. The show tells the story of a real-life murder that took place in Atlanta, Georgia in 1913. It's not all doom and gloom. There's also a love story and a theme of looking past difficult circumstances to a bright future. This production has been resonating with local audiences enough that the theater has extended the show's run. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson spoke with the show's director, Alex Monroe, about why the play is important for today's audiences.
So Parade tells the true story of Leo and Lucille Frank. They were a Jewish couple that lived in Atlanta right around the turn of the 20th century. And on April 26, 1913, a 13-year-old girl named Mary Fagan was found dead in the basement of the National Pencil Factory, which is the factory that Leo supervised. And this was happening at a time where there were newspapers competing for dominance in the market. There were conversations happening about child labor. There was concerns about outsiders. And so after a short investigation, the fingers got pointed to Leo as the culprit. And he was run through a trial where he was convicted. And after a 2-year pressure campaign, the governor eventually reopened the case. And the story is ultimately a tragic one for Leo, but the production celebrates the resiliency and hope that he and his wife felt throughout the whole process.
And romance is at the center of this too, right?
It is. You know, in real life, Leo and Lucille had a very happy marriage. But one of the things that the musical does is kind of portray a marriage that's a little bit on the rocks. And through this tragedy, through these trials, they learn to love each other again. And to witness that is one of the beautiful things about this production, and especially with the two leads that we have, Sam Budd as Leo Frank and Jasmine Haley Anderson as Lucille.
So we have a story from early 20th century history. Mm-hmm. So why now? Why Parade in 2025?
I think probably for many of us right now, it feels very chaotic. And it sometimes can be very scary to think about not just our present, but where our future is leading us. And I think Parade shows us the strength of a community, both for ill and for good. And ultimately in our production, we are showing that there is a way forward and there is a way to overcome this darkness.
As you've gone through the production, how have audiences been reacting with regard to what you just said? Do you feel like your audiences are tapping into that sense of optimism, or is it a hard journey for some audiences?
It's both. You know, sometimes the lights will come up after curtain call and folks have applauded. I've seen people provide some standing ovations, which we always appreciate, but sometimes they just sit back down. They don't immediately go out to the lanai and greet the actors. They just kind of sit and process. We don't tie everything up in a neat little bow. It's a messy show. You're going to cry. You're going to laugh sometimes throughout the production. But I think ultimately we hope that people leave with a sense of wanting to do something and taking strength from Lucille ultimately and using her as a guide forward.
speaking of wanting to do something, there are some historic markers from the actual story that the play is based on that I think resonate even today. And the Anti-Defamation League came out of these circumstances, no?
They did. And this is something that we highlight or acknowledge in the production, this idea that not only did the Anti-Defamation League come out of this, but a lot of historians point to the death of Leo and the death of Mary as the resurgence of the KKK. And so the show is really about how our history is always one where we have folks on the side of justice and we have folks on the side of injustice, on the side of progress and tolerance and on the side of intolerance. And it's messy and it's challenging, but we're encouraging our audiences to decide where they want to stand, which parade they want to follow.
Tell me how you came to this production.
Sure. I've known about Parade for years. It's one of my all-time favorite musicals. It's something I've always wanted to work on and direct. And the team that they assembled for us, Jenny Sharoma as our music director, David Weaver as our choreographer, Jill and Olivia as our assistant directors, are the best people I could have ever asked to work with. We have 22 people in our cast. No egos, no divas. Everyone from day one just rallied around the show. They rallied around the themes. They rallied around each other, and they've provided the space that they needed to make very brave and courageous choices. Some of our actors are playing some pretty despicable human beings, but they provided those despicable human beings with a three-dimensionality that they need in order to tell this story. As we've been kind of communicating with our audiences, I think it's just been really important for us as our team just to kind of convey just how incredible this whole process has been. It's been one of the smoothest, most artistically satisfying collaborations I've been part of. And I think it shows on stage. I think that's why it's resonating so well with our audiences. It's why we extended. And I think it's why Parade has endured over the past two decades. And they just recently announced, the Fulton County District Attorney just recently announced that they're going to revisit the case.
Oh, wow.
Because they never truly exonerated Leo. They apologized for not protecting him, ultimately, from his kidnappers. But they've never said whether or not they can exonerate him.
Because we should say the more challenging part of the show is the fact of Leo's end. Spell that out for us.
Sure. This is not... It's not technically a spoiler. You can go on any Wikipedia article or podcast that talks about the Leo Frank case. So ultimately, Governor Slayton, the governor of Atlanta at the time, of Georgia at the time, he decided to reopen the case and he commuted his sentence to life in prison. And they moved Leo to a different prison outside of Atlanta. But a group of men kidnapped Leo, took him to Marietta, where Mary was from, and they lynched him. And for anyone who's listening who's not familiar with the story but does want to look more into it before maybe seeing the show, just as a warning, there were photos of Leo hanging from a tree. A mob gathered and ripped clothes from his body, made postcards. It's a really heartbreaking end to Leo's story. But I think one of the beautiful things about Parade is somehow they made a musical about this. And it's one that's both respectful but beautiful at the same time. And I don't know how they did it. I know how Alfred Uhry and Jason Robert Brown and Hal Prince pulled that off, but it's quite a testament to their art.
And I think for listeners familiar with other of Alfred Uhry's plays like Driving Miss Daisy and Last Night at Ballyhoo, they'll understand that while there is real tragedy wrapped up in the details you just gave, he does have a gift for, as you've referenced before, bringing some sense of forward-looking into looking back at these tough historical moments, right? Bringing some resiliency, bringing some sense of how humans can connect and move past these moments.
Absolutely. And still celebrate that there was joy at the time. You know, in Act Two, there's a scene that's at the governor's mansion. They're having a ball. There's people who are laughing. Even between Leo and Lucille, they find moments where they can connect and be a couple and share their love. And so I think that's a really helpful reminder for those of us who are feeling fearful right now and feeling that chaos, is to remember that we can still find those moments of joy, and that's okay. We need that to help us carry forward.
You mentioned the recent revival that happened on Broadway, and of course there was the successful initial run in the 90s, the Tony Award winning production. Did the cast study those productions at all? Any connective tissue between this production and those earlier productions?
They did, especially because our choreographer, David, was in the original workshop. He played the young soldier. And what's wonderful about David is not only is he just an incredibly kind, warm, empathetic human being and so talented, but just like our cast, no ego. There was never a sense of, oh, well, you know, on Broadway, we did this, right? It was, I want to tell this story in 2025 in Honolulu with this cast and with this team. And the work that he did that's shown on that stage is breathtaking. There are certain moments, and it's hard to talk about because even with the reviews that we've had, folks don't want to spoil it, but there's something that happens towards the end of Act One that everyone walks out talking about, just how visually striking it is to witness.
All right, a little seed planted there. Mm-hmm. And I have to imagine that doing such a play is exhausting for the performers. I mean, performing is exhausting in general, but a play that's so weighty and so meaningful and has so much humanity in it must be exhausting. Tell us about sort of the lead actors and, yeah, anything you understand about sort of the process they've been going through and how they're handling being in this production.
It is exhausting and it is a hard show. And part of our process was doing check-ins. So we would have company-wide conversations about the show, about the themes, about how everyone feels playing these characters and living in this world for 2 hours. It's changed lives. Our actor who plays Lucille, she recently wrote on social media how playing this character has changed how she wants to do art and to tell stories. And she says how in her own life, in her own challenges, over the past few months, she has turned to Lucille as a model on how to overcome them and to find light in that darkness. And I suspect, based on all the conversations I've had with the cast, based on their group chats, I think it's been true for most of them that they have found strength in this show and within the community that they have built amongst themselves.
Light in the darkness. I think that's a really good way of capturing what Parade is about, because there is a lot of darkness there, but in the center, at the end, is that light. And I think that's sort of the guiding principle for the show.
100%. And Parade can be a hard show to talk about, and especially when we're trying to encourage audiences to come see the show, because in these difficult times, do you really want to sit through a 2-hour musical about tragedy? And yes, it is sad. And yes, Leo's ultimate fate is tragic. But this show is a celebration of love, of hope, of resiliency, of truth. And that's something that we really hope that the audiences, that will inspire audiences to come and see the show.
That was Alex Monroe, director of the Manoa Valley Theater's production of Parade, talking with HPR's D.W. Gibson. The production has been extended through April 13th, and we will have more information on our website later today. And that's it for our show today.